Turns to get rid of Tore. Henning looked over at Helberg, who was now staring out of the passenger window. But Merck was never anything other than a middleman, someone who acted on behalf of others. Helberg removed something that had got stuck between his lips.
"Please, Helberg," Henning asked. "You said yourself we've got a way to drive. It wouldn't hurt to talk a little in the meantime."
Helberg looked over at him again. Henning could tell that he was on the right track. Helberg took a packet of cigarettes out from the inner pocket of his jacket and lit up. Henning tried not to cough.
"I tried to get them to make up again," Helberg said.
"Tore and Charlie?" Helberg took a drag and nodded. The fact they weren't talking wasn't good for any of us. They knew too much about each other, and not least, they knew too much about Preben and myself.
"So, you took on a kind of mediator role?"
"You could call it that. But they were both stubborn fools, loose cannons. The number of ridiculous situations they got themselves into, you've no idea." He shook his head.
"But then a patrol car was sent out to talk to you and Tore, so your name ended up in an indicia report."
Henning saw out of the corner of his eye that he nodded.
"And it couldn't stay there, not after you'd arranged for him to be killed."
Helberg suddenly turned and looked at Henning.
"He threatened you, didn't he? From prison?" asked Henning.
Helberg didn't answer.
"Tore became a desperate man after serving a year and a half for a murder he didn't commit, and apart from Preben Merck and Charlie Highseater, there was only one man who knew about your role in what went on in Natal, and everything that happened here in the wake of Bodil Svenkerun's death, and how you threatened my sister."
Henning could see his conclusions were right.
"Not only that, Tore also knew something crucial about your family. He had, after all, killed someone for your mother, and he knew why she wanted her sister-in-law out of the way."
Henning thought about the envelope that Tore had kept in his safe, the letter that went a long way to prove that Helberg property, of which William was the director, was established with blood money. He might manage to wangle his way out of that, the sins of the father and all that, and maybe even pay a symbolic sum in order to morally redeem himself and the other living members of the Helberg family. But it might also implicate his mother in an unsolved murder, and Tore knew about Preben's role as a middleman. He knew too much, so he had to die. Helberg took a long drag on his cigarette and then shook his head before blowing out the smoke.
"Tore wanted me to pay for a private investigation into his case," he said. "But of course I couldn't do that. It would only lead to a lot of questions."
He snorted, then sighed, put the cigarette in his mouth while he got out his mobile phone again, checked the screen, then put it back.
"And when Tore got in touch with you, you who might get him to tell you everything so you could write about it in your paper, well, there was no going back."
He took another deep drag on the cigarette. "But most of all, I was frightened that he would say something about what happened in Natal," he said, and slowly exhaled. "That it was my idea to blame Bjelland when the police carried out the major operation against the property sector down there in 2007. Tora's word was still worth a good deal in those circles, and there was a risk that any revenge on their part might harm my family. And I couldn't allow that to happen."
Henning thought about Bjelland and the information he'd given Ivar, which led to Ivar's murder.
Bjelland was still a potential danger for Helberg, which meant it would be wise not to mention that they'd been in touch. Had it not been for the display on the dashboard, Henning wouldn't have believed the engine was running. It was so quiet in the car.
like sitting in a machine that hovered over the ground. Hellberg looked out of the window, cigarette between his fingers, leaning on his elbow against the door.
So, now you've got rid of everyone who might cause you problems, Henning said. Tore, Preben, Charlie. And by this evening you'll have killed me, too.
What then? Hellberg shrugged. You thought you'd just go back to being the good citizen for the rest of your life. Hellberg shrugged again.
Who knows? He said.
I don't think you can, Henning said. It's not in your blood. You'll miss solving problems for people, proving to yourself that you've still got the brains. People like you don't change.
Hellberg laughed, but didn't say anything.
They slipped into silence again. Henning would have preferred to take the back roads where time didn't go so fast, where the lower speed limit would allow him to admire the trees and autumn, where the stones and rock faces would be close enough for him to see the cracks. Jonas always used to point at everything when they were driving and comment on the colors, the cars, the ones that looked like they could go fast. The thought of Jonas brought him back down to earth.
Was it your idea to set fire to my flat, too?
Hellberg turned towards him again, took a last drag on his cigarette, then stumped it out in the ashtray. He opened the window a little, so the sound of the wind filled the car. He closed it again, and immediately there was silence.
Charlie asked if I had any suggestions, Hellberg said, but didn't explain.
He didn't need to, either. Henning understood the rest. Hellberg had come up with a plan. Merck had hired people who could do the job, as he always had done, while Hellberg himself kept a low profile. Which was why he didn't know the details of what would happen on the street where Henning lived on the 11th of September 2007, the night Jonas died. A car sped past to Henning's left. The woman sitting in the passenger seat sent him a long look. She had the same short brown hair as Nora. Henning wondered where she might have gone. What would happen to her after all this?
There's just one more thing I wonder about, Henning said.
Hellberg turned his head.
The day I was shot, it was you who told them, wasn't it, that I was on my way back to Oslo?
He didn't answer straight away.
I'd been to your house, after all, Henning said. You could quite easily have noted what kind of car I was driving. The registration number?
Hellberg gave a fleeting smile.
Didn't you just tell them that I was going to police headquarters?
Henning finished.
Hellberg said, I wouldn't have got this far if I didn't have a degree of intuition. You told me that you hadn't shared your theories about Preben with the police yet, so it was only a matter of time before you did.
Henning nodded, reflected on what lay ahead. A thought struck him. He could drive off the road, into a rock face or an oncoming lorry. Then it would be over and done with straight away. And he'd kill Hellberg in the bargain. He would get his revenge. He'd thought about it so many times, about what he would do when confronted with the person responsible for Jonas's death. But now that he was actually here, when he could actually do something to this person, he realized he didn't have it in him to kill someone, that he wanted to live for as long as possible. He hoped for a miracle. But he also hoped that death, when it came, would be painless, that it wouldn't be drawn out. He didn't know exactly how long they'd been driving, but it had to be close to 2 hours. They'd driven straight through Oslo and on, east. Hellberg had dialed a number and said they were on their way. there was more and more forest, and fewer cars. Then Hellberg instructed him to turn onto a forest track. Immediately the tires crunched, and Henning drove slowly, as though to delay the inevitable for as long as possible. The sky above them was increasingly drab. It would soon be dark, and the evening would be chilly in the forest.
Chapter 55. Bjarne was waiting for a phone call when Pierre Nurkelby knocked on his office door and came straight in.
"Have you got time for a quick meeting?" she asked.
Not really," Bjarne replied.
Nurkelby took another step into the room and looked at him expectantly, thinking he would give an explanation. And when he didn't, she said, "Okay, I'll tell you very quickly then before I brief the others. Tora Pulley was in frequent contact with William Hellberg in the weeks before he was killed. You know who that is, don't you?"
Bjarne nodded and straightened up ever so slightly.
"Of course, it doesn't need to mean anything, but I think he's someone we should look at more closely," Pierre Nurkelby said. "Preben Merck was his lawyer. There must be a connection somewhere."
There had to be, Bjarne thought.
Nurkelby waited for him to say something, and when he didn't, she added,
"Well, okay, come as soon as you can then."
Bjarne could see that she was agitated. She always got a flush on her throat when she was tense. She turned on her heel and closed the door behind her. Bjarne sat there, looking at his phone.
"Come on," he thought. "Ring."
The forest made Henning think about another murder case he'd worked on many years ago. A man had been found on a bonfire, killed by his brother-in-law. It was the result of a family feud about who owned what and where. The case had fascinated him, seeing just how little it took for so much to go wrong in a family. A boundary here, a limit there. The man, who eventually confessed to the murder, didn't even like the forest. Cases, Henning thought. Crime cases had been his life for so long. He enjoyed meeting people, passing through their lives, winning their trust and their stories, then going back to the office, his fingertips itching with words and sentences. To see the result in the next day's paper or the weekend supplement, spread over 5, maybe even 6 columns, certain that he had touched someone's life, changed something, put the focus on something. It had been important. It felt like an eternity since he'd been that person, and it had been a long and painful journey. He was exhausted, damaged, tired of the constant pain, tired of the hunt. But he finally found a peace inside. There was a time when he'd cultivated that stillness. He'd sought it out, and had only sporadically found it, on the terraces at the Dahlonega football ground, or in his own flat. He'd wallowed in the melancholy, stared at the walls, had scarcely put a foot out the door. He hadn't even listened to music. But he would give anything to be able to do that one more time. And to see the sea one more time as well. Experience the peace that always filled him when he saw its vast expanse. He would have loved to go out on the water to fish, watch the sun go down over the horizon, to see the moon rise over the rocks and cast a greenish-white shimmer on the black eternity. He would love to see the stars in the sky, never clearer than at the cottage in Stavern. He would have talked to people, tried to get to know them, would have looked for things that made him laugh. He would have read more books, drunk ridiculously expensive wines. He would have smoked a cigar, moist and full of flavor, and he would have stared into the flames and seen his own son there, without crying.
"Over there," Hellberg said, pointing to a red cabin.
Henning was roused from his thoughts. There was a silver-gray van outside. He accelerated a little. The road was narrow and bumpy, but William Helberg's big car was easy to steer, even with only one arm. Soon, they were in front of the cabin. Henning turned off the engine. Helberg opened the door as soon as he stopped the engine and got out, slammed the door shut. The whole car shuddered. Henning sat still in the silence for a few seconds. He wondered if he would fight death when it approached, when the pain started and the seconds ticked by towards that one final destination. He wondered if he'd be frightened, if he would cry. He got out and breathed in the smell of the forest and the evening, raw and chill. The door to the cabin opened, and Red Zeppi came out. He had a gun in his hand. Henning caught his eye for a moment, but then found his own eyes drawn to the red splashes on his T-shirt. They looked like blood, and his hand was also covered in small red dots, as though something had sprayed him at close quarters. But now he was heading straight for Henning with a determined step. Chapter 56. Pierre Nerkelby was pleased with the meeting. It had been efficient and quick, and they were already taking action. But it was important not to get William Helberg in too soon. First, they had to understand why Tora Pulley had spoken to him so often on the phone, and what kind of connection they had in the past. The head of investigations, Harald Gierstad, had been instructed to ring Turnsberg police immediately to get all the information they had on Helberg. They would also check Helberg's phone log to see who else he'd been in touch with around that time, and who he had been in touch with more recently. But most of all, they needed to know where Helberg had been the evening that Preben Merk was killed, and where he was now. There was a lot to do all at once, and at the same time the search for Durim Red Zeppi had intensified. They needed all the hands they could get, so Pierre Nerkelby knocked on Bjarne Brogeland's door again and walked in without waiting. But he wasn't there. Nerkelby turned and went out into the corridor, spotted Ella Sandland going into her office and called to her, then hurried to catch up. "What is it?" Sandland asked. "Have you seen Bjarne?" Sandland shook her head. "Have you tried calling him?" she asked. "No, but he was in his office not long ago, busy with something, and he was supposed to come to a meeting when he was done." Sandland shrugged. "I've no idea what he's up to." Henning half expected Durim Red Zeppi to aim and shoot him down, but it didn't happen. Instead, he stopped in front of them. "Hello, Durim," Henning said. "Nice to see you again." Red Zeppi didn't answer. He looked over at Helberg and said, "Have you got the money?" "It's in the car," Helberg said.
"Get it."
Helberg hesitated a moment. Red Zeppi made a movement with the gun in the direction of the car.
"Okay, relax," Helberg said. "I'll get it."
Helberg turned and went back to the car. Henning quickly understood the relationship between Helberg and Red Zeppi, non-existent until Preben Merk, Daddy Longlegs, had to die. Henning wondered if he could exploit that in some way, draw out the time he had before the inevitable. Helberg opened the boot and got out a small black sports bag. It wasn't long before he was back. "Do you want to count it?" Red Zeppi seemed to consider it.
"I don't think you're dumb enough to try it on," he said. "Not now that I've seen your face. But I was starting to wonder. It took you so long to get here."
Helberg pointed to Henning.
"This man here suddenly showed up out of the blue, handy for us, as we don't need to keep looking for him or wonder if he's finally called it a day."
Helberg threw the bag down at Red Zeppi's feet.
"You should be grateful. You don't need to hang around here any longer than necessary now."
Red Zepi glared at him. Where's Bjelland? Helberg asked. Henning turned quickly towards him.
Bjelland?
Helberg made an I-didn't-have-any-choice movement with his hands.
He's lying in the boat, Red Zepi said.
Henning turned and peered through the trees, saw there was a lake nearby. He studied Red Zeppi's hand again, the red spots, the splashes on his T-shirt. He closed his eyes, recalling what he'd said to Bjelland not long ago. Right now, people around me have a tendency to end up dead.
There was quite a mess, Red Zepi said. And I'd already cleaned the whole cabin. There's no way I'm doing that again.
So what are you thinking? To kill him out here? Helberg nodded towards Henning.
No,
Red Zepi said.
He can come out in the boat. Less to wash. I've been here too long. I want to leave as soon as I can.
Henning opened his eyes. You know it'll be you next, he said to Red Zepi. Red Zepi squinted at him. Afterwards, when you're done here, you're the only one who's seen Helberg's face and knows that he's behind it all. You've worked for Urjan Mjerns. You've worked for Preben Merk, or rather Daddy Longlegs, as you probably knew him. You knew a lot about most of them. But this guy, Henning said, and nodded in Helberg's direction, he's made sure that anyone who can identify him is killed. So, why would he suddenly spare you? Red Zepi glanced over at Helberg. And do you think he'll just let you go with all that money? Henning pointed at the sports bag. He lives for his money, Henning said, and he'll do everything he can to protect his family. I have no interest whatsoever in harming you, Red Zepi. Helberg had adopted his salesman face and calm, reassuring voice. He's just trying to make you uncertain, he continued. But there's no need to worry. As soon as we're done here, I'm going home. Then it's all over and you can leave, go wherever you want. He threw open his arms. He's got a gun in his inner pocket, Henning said to Red Zepi. Why do you think he's got that with him? That was for you, Helberg said to Henning, in case you didn't want to come of your own free will. Do you dare take the chance that he's a man of his word? Henning said to Red Zepi. Do you dare take the chance that he's not going to turn his gun on you? Henning shook his head. I certainly wouldn't. Henning could see that he'd made Red Zepi doubt, but he was still the one holding a gun. You mentioned the boat, Henning carried on. Is it big enough for all four of us? Is Helberg coming with us too? He could see Red Zeppi's mind working overtime. I'll wait here until you're back, Helberg assured him. You don't need to worry.
There's no reason for him to wait. Once you've rowed us out onto the lake.
Red Zepi looked at Helberg.
I don't know you,
the Kosovo Albanian said.
I don't have any guarantee that you'll wait.
Helberg sighed. I realize it might all seem a bit suspect, but...
Give me your gun,
Red Zepi said aggressively.
Come on, give it to me, now.
Helberg gave him an exasperated look before he reluctantly did as he'd been told. He made quite a show of putting it down on the ground and then standing up slowly with his hands raised. Red Zepi moved over and picked up the gun, put it in the sports bag.
You're coming with us down to the lake,
Red Zepi said, glaring at Helberg.
There's not enough room on the boat, but you'll wait down there.
You decide, but could we step on it, please? It's starting to get dark, and I'd like to get home while there's some of the evening left. Red Zepi looked at Henning, indicating that he should move.
Where? Henning said, playing stupid.
There,
Red Zeppi said, and pointed to the lake.
And fast.
Henning nearly stumbled on a root that had grown over the path. Hellberg was behind him, with Red Zeppi bringing up the rear. In front of them, the black water glittered. He heard an owl. Was it an eagle owl? It was colder now. It didn't take long for them to reach the edge of the lake. A boat had been pulled up on the shore. There was a big, black, oblong package already in it.
Sit there,
Red Zeppi said to Hellberg, and pointed at a tree nearby.
Honestly, Red,
I don't give a shit what you say. It'll take 10 minutes to row out to the middle of the lake and back, and 10 minutes is more than enough time for you to get away from here, so sit next to that tree over there.
Red Zeppi went over to the boat, picked up a knife that was lying there, and cut a 2-meter length of rope. He was on his way back to Hellberg when he stopped in his tracks.
What is it? Hellberg asked.
I thought I heard something,
Red Zeppi said. None of them moved. They all listened. There was silence.
What did you hear? Hellberg asked.
Don't know,
Red Zeppi said, but Henning could see that he was unsettled, on his guard. He listened again. Heard nothing. For a brief moment, Henning hoped it was Bjarne, that he had somehow managed to find them, but he immediately dismissed the thought as ridiculous. He wondered if any of this could have been different if he'd let Bjarne know, told him en route that he was on his way to talk to Anne Cecily Hellberg. Maybe, maybe not. Nora would still be under threat, and William Hellberg would still be Durim Red Zeppi's employer. If Hellberg had been caught earlier, and if he'd been sentenced, he might still have been able to get to Nora from prison, through Red Zeppi. He could have made his threat good from there, as some kind of revenge or punishment. But now, there was no reason for Hellberg to go after Nora. She could no longer be used as leverage to get to Henning. She was safe. The child was safe. That's all that mattered to him. Red Zeppi grabbed Hellberg's arm and pulled him over to the tree, forced him to sit down. Is this really necessary, Red Zeppi? Hellberg was breathing fast and hard and seemed to hate the fact that his suit was becoming damp and dirty.
Yes, hands behind your back.
Hellberg rolled his eyes. Red Zeppi tied him to the tree, then straightened up, looked around, in among the trees. Listened. He looked at Henning and nodded towards the boat. Henning took the first hesitant step. A good thing Bjelland's body hadn't started to smell yet, he thought. The boat rocked when Henning got in. He turned towards Hellberg, kept an eye on him all the time, even when Red Zeppi put one foot in the boat and used the other to push off from the shore. They slid out onto the lake. The water rippled along the bow, making a sucking, lapping sound. My last journey, Henning thought, and noticed a mist drifting in over the silent, dark water. Red Zeppi sat down in the middle of the boat and grabbed the oars. Then he started to row. Chapter 57. Bjarne drove as fast as he could, out of town, unsure if the car would take the strain. It was a while since it had been serviced, and he'd noticed that the engine had been making some funny noises recently. Luckily, the worst of the rush hour was over, and the cars pulled obediently onto the hard shoulder when he flashed his lights and tooted the horn. And, if there was a queue, the siren always came in handy. His phone rang. It was Pia Nerkelby. "Hi, Bjarne," she said. "Where are you? What are you up to?" Bjarne explained the situation and why he'd had to make such a hasty exit.
Okay, she said. Just don't do anything stupid before we get there.
A tractor appeared on the road in front of him. Because there were other cars around, he had to slow down and weave between the vehicles that were trying to get out of his way. The loss of those few minutes frustrated him.
I don't think there's time to wait for you, he said.
Do what you think is best, Nurkleby said. Where are you?
Just turned off at Grönmo.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bjarne accelerated again as he zoomed the GPS down to 500 meters and saw on the map there were small roads and lakes everywhere. Ideal if you wanted to get rid of someone. He was on Highway 155, trees in every direction. Because he was driving so quickly, it felt like he was encapsulated, as though the forest around him was a narrow tunnel with high walls. 10 minutes later, he studied the map again and saw a small side road a few hundred meters in front of him. He slowed down and turned off. The car was immediately swallowed by the trees, and the headlamp shone between the trunks and branches. He turned them off, drove a little further, stopped, saw a cabin about 200 meters away on his right. There were two cars outside. One was a silver van, the other a black SUV. The lights were on in the cabin. Bjarne took some binoculars from the glove compartment, adjusted the focus, and looked at the cars. He turned off the engine, hurried round to the back of his car, and opened his gun case. He ran down the gravel without closing the case or the boot. He didn't notice that he passed another car, a Lexus, hidden behind some trees nearby. Durim Redzepi watched Henning Jul sink down into the water. He waited for about 30 seconds. Then he put the oars back in the locks, backed away, then turned the boat round and headed towards the shore. The mist lay thick on the surface now, so he couldn't see further than 10 meters ahead. The only sound he could hear was the oars in the water dripping off, interwoven with his own breathing, which was fast, but easy. He stopped rowing, sure that he'd heard something from the water. He peered into thick mist, but saw nothing. He couldn't hear anything but the sound of the boat gliding through the dark, cold water. Death cramps, he thought. Air bubbles. He carried on towards the shore, and before long, he could see William Hellberg.
I see that went okay,
Hellberg shouted, with a satisfied nod. Redzepi didn't answer, but steered the boat into the spot where he'd left it before, let the speed of the boat carry it the final stretch. There was a scraping under the hull. He pushed one of the oars to the bottom and felt the mud give way, but it was still firm enough to get the boat up onto land. Suddenly, the boat came to a halt, and he could get out. He didn't bother to pull it up any further. He stumbled up the path to Hellberg and loosened the rope.
Now, I've kept my side of the deal, he said. Where are my wife and daughter? Where are Svetlana and Dorontina?
Hellberg stood up and assessed the damage to his suit, brushed off some leaves and grass, and smoothed the trouser legs. Shall we go back to the cabin? He suggested.
No, Redzepi said. Here and now, I've waited long enough, done more than enough shit for you to tell me what you know about my girls.
He pulled out the gun and aimed at Hellberg.
Take it easy, Hellberg said with a sigh. I'll tell you what you want to know. But I'm not actually sure that you really want to know the truth.
Redzepi squinted at him. Hellberg got the packet of cigarettes from his inner pocket and lit one. He offered one to Redzepi, but he just shook his head. Your brother, Helberg said, drawing the nicotine down into his lungs. He's not a good person.
Red Zeppi frowned.
As I said to you on the phone, we checked what he had actually done with the money you'd sent him. And do you know what Daddy Longlegs found out?
Red Zeppi just stared at him and waited for the answer.
Do you know what your brother's been doing? Helberg took another drag.
Nothing, Durim. Absolutely nothing.
Red Zeppi didn't know what to say. There are two possible explanations, Helberg said, and started to walk towards the cars and the cabin. Either he can't be bothered to look for them, but he's quite happy for you to send him money all the time. After all, he knows that you can't go back, because you're wanted for double murder.
He gesticulated as he walked. Red Zeppi followed behind him.
Or it could be that he's found them, but doesn't think there's any point in telling you, for the same reason. He likes you sending him money. But Daddy Longlegs's man never established whether he'd found them or not.
Red Zeppi blinked furiously as he considered what he'd just heard. For so many years, he'd prepared himself to hear that they were dead. That was the conclusion he'd come to himself. But he hadn't been prepared for this. Not at all. The next moment, a branch cracked right beside them.
"Stay where you are, both of you!"
a loud voice shouted. Red Zeppi turned his head towards the trees and saw a dark shape step out on the right, just ahead of them. Red Zeppi could only see the outline of his body and that he was holding something in his hands.
"Put down the gun!"
The voice was clear. Red Zeppi's instinct screamed, "Do something before it's too late." Shoot! It was two against one. It might work. But the man in front of him was a policeman, and he had a gun in his hands that was pointing straight at Red Zeppi's chest. He wouldn't have time to do anything. And presumably, the policeman had let others know where he was, so more were on their way. Red Zeppi thought about his brother. If he was ever to see him again, if he was ever finally to find out what happened to Svetlana and Dorontina, he couldn't chance a shootout. He had to play the long game. He was still in his 40s, would have plenty of time when he got out of prison, years that he could dedicate to making his brother's life hell. Red Zeppi sank to his knees and dropped the gun. The policeman was quick to move and kicked it away from him.
"Where's Henning?"
he asked. Red Zeppi felt the handcuffs close around his wrists. The policeman looked around. Neither Helberg nor Red Zeppi answered.
"Where's Henning Juhl?"
The policeman stood up.
"Henning!"
The frantic cry disappeared over the water and was soon swallowed by the mist. The man shaded his eyes with both hands and looked from side to side. Red Zeppi turned towards the blue flashing light that looked like it was dancing among the trees. It was only a matter of minutes before the place would be crawling with cars and men and women in uniform.
"Where's Henning?"
the policeman shouted again, looking at Red Zeppi, then Helberg. Neither of them answered. A film seemed to fall over Helberg's face, like a mask. The policeman bent down over Red Zeppi and shook him.
"Where is he? Where is Henning Juhl?"
Red Zeppi took a deep breath. Then he turned his head towards the lake.
"He's out there," he said. "He died about 10 minutes ago."
Epilogue. 8 days later. Ulensaka Church was a little over half full. Trina had perhaps expected there to be a bit more fuss, maybe some media, but it suited her fine. She couldn't face any more than was necessary. She didn't know how long she would need to come to terms with everything that had happened. Perhaps she never would. Pal Frederick took her arm and tucked it in his, pulled her closer. They were sitting at the front, on the left bank of pews. The coffin was in front of them, up by the altar, covered in beautiful flowers. Every now and then she turned to see who had come in, recognized some faces she'd known when she was a girl. Some were crying, others talking quietly, as the organist played a slow tune. Henning would have liked that tune, Trina thought, and a memory from their childhood popped up. The funeral of Leonid Brezhnev, president of the USSR, which was shown on Norwegian television in the 80s. Henning was lying on his stomach under the coffee table listening to the music, and afterwards he said that the intense, sad melodies had filled his body with stillness, in a good way. Trina saw Katerina Hatlam come up the aisle. She pushed back her long, curly red locks and looked at Trina with a small, sympathetic smile. Trina stood up, waved to her former communications director to come to the front. Hatlam hesitated before saying something quickly to the man she'd come with, and then came forward. Trina stepped into the aisle with open arms. "My condolences," Katerina whispered. "Thank you," Trina said, and smiled. "And thank you for coming. Let's talk again afterwards." Katerina smiled. Then she turned and went back. Trina spotted Nora Clementsen, who had come alone. Trina wanted to go over and hug her as well, but had to make do with a nod as the organ stopped playing. She caught a glimpse of Bjarne Brogeland, too, who had been so in love with her when they were younger. She'd spoken to him a lot over the last few days. The church bells rang. Trina sat down again and folded her hands, something she never usually did. The bells clanged in her head, and then a compact silence sank over the congregation. The priest came in and walked straight to her and Pal Frederick, shook her hand first. He said nothing, but his hands and his eyes expressed his sympathy. He was a good man, a fine priest. He had talked with such warmth when he came to see them, all the way out to Ulen, even though it was well outside his parish. He drank his coffee and listened with interested eyes, hadn't asked any sensitive questions, and he'd quietly taken notes. The priest stood in the pulpit and looked out at the congregation. Trina knew she would block out everything he said. She would sing the songs as best she could. She would listen to the man playing Claire de Lune on the piano, and would nod and say thank you and accept the hugs and words of comfort offered outside the church afterwards. The funeral service lasted for 45 minutes, but it felt like hours. On the way out, she walked behind Pal Frederick and the other coffin bearers. Fortunately, it was a beautiful autumn day. On the horizon, a plane was coming in to land on the runway at Gardermoen. The hills were full of colour and blazed in a way they only did in autumn. Red and green and yellow, all mixed together. Trina put on her sunglasses, grateful to be able to hide her eyes. But still she kept them on the ground, and concentrated on not stepping on heels in front of her. Soon they stopped. People gathered around the grave. The white coffin was lowered onto a platform that would then be lowered further into the ground. The priest stood beside it and finished the service with a final hymn, then threw on the earth. Some people went forward and laid red roses on the coffin. Then it was lowered into the ground, after which people started to murmur and crowd around Trina and Pal Frederick. It was while she was embracing someone she'd never met before that she saw him up on the path between the gravestones. He was standing with his hands in his pockets beside Bjarne Brogeland, looking down at them. It felt as though he was looking straight at her, and maybe he was. Trina let go of the woman, who was replaced by a man with a scratchy beard, but she didn't hear what he said, just said thank you and kind of you to come. Henning stood on the path, in a dark suit and sunglasses, and then he started to walk towards them, slowly, as though with dread, his arm in a sling. Some people made their way to him and shook his hand. He nodded, and she heard him say thank you. It took another 15 minutes, perhaps, until people started to drift away, relieved to be able to return to their lives. Trina stood by the grave, which would be covered in earth by the end of the day. She turned towards Henning, who was standing a few meters away, beside Nora Clementson. There was no trace of grief in his eyes. They were just dull, as if he had no energy left. She felt sad, not because both their parents were now dead, but because neither of them had a family of their own, not a whole one. She had denied Pal Henrik a family and was, in part, responsible for Henning losing his. She went over to him. "Hello, Henning," she said.
"Hi, Trina," he replied.
"How..." She couldn't say the rest.
"I'm fine," he said. "How are you?"
Trina opened her hands in a kind of shrug and tried to smile. "I don't quite know what to say." She turned towards the grave. "I didn't see you in the church," Trina said, turning back to him. Henning said,
"No, I don't cope very well with that kind of thing after..."
He glanced over at Nora, before lowering his eyes. Trina hadn't gone to Ivar Gundersen's funeral, which she knew had been held a few days earlier. She presumed that Henning had been there, but possibly in much the same way as today, that he'd stayed in the background. The policeman who found Christine Yule said that she was lying on the floor beside the oxygen therapy stand, with the mask in her hands. It seemed likely that she hadn't been able to turn it on. She was drunk. She had died the same day that Trina had been there, and so she felt she was to blame, given what they'd discussed. "Henning, I have to talk to you," she said.
"It was you," he said.
"Sorry?"
"Who paid the people to follow me," he continued, "to protect me. The ones in the Lexus."
Trina lowered her head and found a patch of ground to focus on.
"Bjarne told me," he said, "that you both agreed on it before he helped me leave the hospital the evening after I'd been shot."
Trina could feel his eyes. It was as though they were boring straight into her head.
"They were following me when I passed out outside Anne-Marie Sarah's house that evening. It was them who drove me to hospital."
Trina felt a tear falling. "So, Bjarne told you everything then?" she asked. He nodded. They had kept an eye on him since he discharged himself from hospital. They'd followed him to Hook, where he met Rasmus Bjelland. Followed him to Tønsberg, where they saw Henning getting into a black SUV, which they followed to the holiday cabin not far from Itra Ennebak. And they'd let Bjarne know, en route. Trina had read the interviews with Henning afterwards, knew that he had at first accepted his fate, that he had sunk deeper and deeper into the dark water, waiting to die. But even people who have decided to commit suicide often end up fighting with the rope they've tied round their neck, and something similar had happened to Henning, far under the water. As his oxygen ran out, his survival instinct kicked in, and he tried to push himself up towards the surface. He wasn't able to, so instead he thought about getting to the shore. It was some way off, 30 meters or so, but it would be easier to pull the weight along behind him than up.
He'd kicked and struggled, even though he knew that Durim Red Zepi would probably kill him if he managed to get there. But then at least, it would be a different death. Then, suddenly, there was light all around him. Beams moving across the murky water. And he had seen shapes, waving arms, and he hadn't understood until some strong hands grabbed hold of him and pulled him up, towards the surface. Trina's former bodyguards did not have guns, but they had kept themselves out of sight and, on a couple of occasions, had been certain that Durim Red Zepi had either seen or heard them. They had moved stealthily through the woods and had seen what was about to happen, so they'd entered the water as quietly as they could. Under the cover of the thickening mist, they swam towards the boat, slowly and largely underwater, and then, when Durim Red Zepi was on his way back towards the shore, they dove under and found Henning. One of the bodyguards who was interviewed later said that it wasn't a particularly deep lake, and Henning had been underwater for less than a minute and a half before they managed to get him to the surface. They were frightened of making too much noise, but Red Zepi hadn't been able to see them through the mist. He'd heard something, he said, when he was being questioned by Bjarne later, but hadn't turned to check. His main concern was to get away. Henning took a step closer to Trina. "You saved my life," he said. Trina stood silently, just looking at him. Then she sobbed.
"It wasn't me."
"Yes, it was," he said. "It was you who saved me. Thank you." Trina's eyes filled up, and she struggled to regain her composure.
"But that wasn't what I wanted to tell you," she said with a sniff.
Henning looked at her, puzzled.
"And I could probably have found a better time to tell you," she said. "But in many ways, it seems right to do it here, in front of them."
She pointed to the open grave and the gravestone alongside it, then gave a sign to Paul Frederick, who immediately suggested to Nora that they should leave and let brother and sister speak in private.
"Will you wait for me up there?" Henning asked, and looked at Nora.
She nodded. And then there was only Henning and Trina. She took a few steps towards the grave, stopped in front of the hole where her mother's coffin lay, beside their father. Jacob died at the age of 44, eternally loved and worshipped by his wife, who, after his death, never stopped hating the realities of life, the fact that she was a widow, and that, in her eyes, it was Henning's fault. Trina hadn't managed to talk or think the morning after their father had committed suicide. It didn't help that their mother just screamed and screamed and screamed, and in the days and weeks that followed, seemed to take up all the space. But even she, deep down, must have known what her husband had done with Henning. Fortunately, not to Henning, which explained why Henning himself didn't seem to know anything. His father had just sat there in Henning's room, looking at him, when he thought that everyone else in the house was asleep, sometimes with the duvet on, sometimes with it off. Trina had been woken up one night by the sounds coming from Henning's room. She'd tiptoed out into the hall towards the light and sounds. She'd peeked round the door and seen her father sitting there, eyes closed, with his trousers off. Trina had stood there transfixed by the fast hand movements, the half-open mouth, the closed eyes. But then the floor creaked underneath her. She hadn't been able to stand still, hadn't been about to tiptoe back, either, and when her father snapped out of his trance, he'd pulled on his trousers and run after her,
Trina had managed to get into her room and lock the door before he reached her. She'd sunk to the floor with her back to the door and cried, while her father had begged her as loudly as he dared in order not to wake the rest of the house to open up. But Trina hadn't opened the door until late the next day, long after he'd gone to work. In the afternoon, when she got home from school, she'd made sure she was never alone with him, and Jacob was silent. He hadn't spoken to Henning or to his wife. It was like being in a dead house. Then, one day, Jacob ambushed her. He hadn't gone to work. Instead, he was waiting for her in the garage where she kept her bike. "Trina," he said, "we have to talk." Trina didn't answer. "I've never laid a hand on Henning. I've never done anything to him." Still, she didn't answer. "Please, Trina, you have to believe me." And then he had tried to make light of what he'd done. He knew that it was wrong, that he should never have done it. But in his eyes, it hadn't hurt Henning in any way, because he didn't know. Jacob Yule had stood there with tears streaming down his cheeks. He'd shaken his head and mumbled that their mother didn't understand, that she'd always been so jealous of Henning because Jacob loved him more than he loved her. She'd told him many times, but she didn't know the ways in which it had manifested itself. It would devastate her, he said, if she discovered what he'd done. And he would be a social pariah everywhere if the truth were to get out. Trina had just stood there looking at him. He'd realized that she would never let him get away with it, and that no doubt was why he'd taken an overdose of insulin one evening, after everyone else had gone to bed. Trina believed that her mother knew, deep down, and that was what she had confronted her with on the last day she was alive. Henning looked at his father's gravestone as he tried to process what Trina had just told him. It should perhaps have hurt. He should perhaps have been disgusted. But he was neither. He felt nothing. It was as though it was all part of someone else's life, perhaps because it happened so long ago, and because he had so few memories of his father. He looked at the open grave. The coffin, beautiful and white, was covered by a thin layer of earth. A few roses had fallen off the coffin and now lay on the ground by the grave. He wondered which way she was lying. He thought about the way his mother had always looked at him, accusingly, her breathing always strained. Hard as he tried, he couldn't remember what she looked like when she smiled. They should really raise a glass of St. Halvard liqueur, he thought, in honor of the poor soul who had been their mother. But it was hardly appropriate in a graveyard. Perhaps Trina had brought a few bottles for the reception. He offered her his good arm as they started to walk up towards the car park. She took it, and they walked in silence between the gravestones. Nora and Pal Frederick were waiting for them by the cars. "I won't be coming to the reception," Henning said to Trina. "No, I guessed that you wouldn't," she said with a careful smile. They stood there looking at each other. An airplane thundered overhead as it ascended into the sky. Trina took a step towards him and opened her arms. Henning let her in. It felt so strange to hug his own sister again. It must have been at least 20 years since they last hugged. But she had protected him for so many years, held the truth inside. The fact that they hadn't had much contact was perhaps Trina's way of protecting herself as well, so she wouldn't be reminded of what had happened. Trina pulled away from him and dried a tear, took a step back, and then another. Then she lifted her hand in a brief wave. "Goodbye," she said. He lifted his hand too. "Bye." Henning and Nora stayed by the cars and watched Trina and Pal Frederick drive off.
"Was it okay?"
Nora asked. Henning turned to her.
"Hmm? Your little chat?"
She nodded down towards the grave.
"Oh, yes," Henning said. "Yes, that's fine, in a way."
Nora pulled her dark grey coat tighter around her. As always, her cheeks were rosy after being out in the autumn air, and her lips were dry. They stood there and listened to the silence.
"So, what happens now?"
she asked. Henning took a deep breath.
"Jorim Redzepi's behavior during questioning has been exemplary," he said. "I think he's doing everything he can to get a good deal, which of course has made it harder for William Hellberg and Erjan Mjerns. Redzepi's got a lot of key information on them all."
He shrugged and winced at the pain in his shoulder.
"I meant with you," Nora said. "What happens with you?"
Henning looked at her for a long time.
I don't know, Nora.
The sun went behind a cloud, and it got colder straight away. Nora put her hand on her stomach and tried hard not to pull a face.
"Is it..."
Henning pointed to her stomach.
"I just feel a bit sick," she said.
He nodded.
"Would you like a lift home?"
She shook her head and pointed to a car that was parked a bit further along. They stood looking at each other for some time, both thinking about that other grave, back in Oslo.
"Okay," he said eventually. "Well, see you around then, and thank you for coming."
Henning had spent the first few days after he'd been fished out of the water at home, in his own bed. He'd slept, eaten, slept again. He'd had a cup of tea with his old neighbor, Gunnar Gomer, who'd recently had a heart operation. And Gunnar had told him about the war, about all the ladies he'd known, about all the cafes he still frequented in Grunelocker. Always with nitroglycerine in one pocket and a tooth guard in the other, ready to defend a damsel in distress. Henning had smiled and wondered what he would be like when he was old. He'd bought himself a wok and finally started to use the gas cooker that had stood unused for as long as he'd lived in the flat.